Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up in today's show, journalists Trevor Burney and Barry McCaffrey on their arrest for their investigation into the Loughton Island murders. Phelim Drew sings the songs of his wonderful father Ronnie. We'll have some great music from Wyvern Lingo and we'll remember the late great Philomena Lynott. Our text number 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie and you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Call. Well, this morning we're going to begin with some music and to Ballinlough Castle in County Westmeath, where on June the 21st, the Body and Soul Festival will celebrate its 10th anniversary, or what they're calling 10 years of joy. And this year, among the lineup is Wyvern Lingo, the Bray Trio, which began by supporting their school friend Hosier, and they've become hugely successful in their own right. And Wyvern Lingo are standing in front of me now. Good morning, all of you.
Morning.
That's Karen Cowley, Saoirse Dewan, and Caoimhe Barry. Listen, you're going to start off by singing one of your own songs. Tell me about the first song. What is it?
This is a song called Dark Cloud, and it's about when you go through a trauma with someone, and you know, you're trying to be there for them, but also keep yourself in a good place mentally.
Okay, yeah. Great. Off you go.
But there is a dark cloud, and I the only one in her atmosphere. She keeps me warm, yeah, she keeps me near in the dead of night. But there is a dark cloud, and when it rains I get drenched from head to toe. She doesn't seem, no, she never knows I'm not alright. But there is a dark cloud. To the droplets perched on the vines and leaves in quiet defeat. But there is a dark cloud, and there is no shelter from her rain. Still I follow through misty wet terrain underneath my feet. All I ever asked for was a piece of my own space.
That's a beautiful song. Come back over and chat to me. So where did the three of you meet again? Saoirse?
We all met in school. We did a lot of Christmas concerts and stuff like that together. So we've been friends for a long, long time now.
Where are we in school?
Loretta Bray. Bray's class.
Shout out to our music teacher, Miss Mahon, who actually made us form the band for real and was very supportive. Mm. We were very lucky to have a very very good school for music. I think we owe a lot to that.
That's actually great to hear, because a lot of people I interviewed, they do often mention like an important teacher. Yeah. And that music teacher was obviously very significant in your career development.
Yeah, like she was at our album launch last year. Like, you know, she was very much stayed in touch. And you know, when you're 14 and you're not really taking things very seriously, she was very, I guess, pivotal for us, kind of making us get our stuff together and play the concerts whenever we could. So yeah.
And when you write, do you write together as a trio? What's your process or procedure as the three of you?
We change that a good bit. So sometimes, like, one of us will write the bones of a song, and then we bring it to the group and we'd change and rewrite it together. But it all depends, really. Kind of if we're in the rehearsal room, we might just lash out a song together, or else we might just write a song on the guitar at home in your own room, kind of thing. So it depends, really.
You began as an indie folk band, but your sound, it's really evolved. How would you describe it now?
That's an interesting one. Because we did start, I think, more in the realm of folk, but the reason for that was more because we didn't have as many instruments as we have now. We were working off keyboard and acoustic guitar, and over the last kind of four or five years we've really put a lot of work into learning about production, and we upgraded all our instruments and became more confident musicians. So we never really set out to make folk music. It's sort of just how it happened, and then we finally got the confidence to really be able to produce and write the music that we wanted to. So what people call us now, to answer your question, is more of a kind of alternative R&B rock kind of thing. It's still not the easiest thing to pin down, but we're okay with that.
Yeah. Absolutely. It does take time for a band to find its own sound anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And Karen, is it you who's the main connection with Hozier?
Yeah, Andrew and I were in a band together in the very early days of college called Zaska. And Zaska is still going. Max Zaska is a great musician. We used to just sing together, and we were in Trinity Orchestra together, and we kind of just spent all those young college days singing around Dublin. So it was amazing. And then obviously he took off with his own music, and that's just been incredible for us to kind of be somewhat of a fly on the wall and seeing that happen. And he was hugely inspirational to us, and still is very supportive to us in our own career. So
he's a very nice guy as well, as being a superstar.
You can't get nicer, like. Yeah.
Wyvern Lingo, where did the name come from, Saoirse?
The name came from our music teacher, which we mentioned earlier. She was like, you have to pick a name now for the Christmas concert. We can't be calling you Karen Cleave and Saoirse. And I was like, oh, I don't even think I was there. And the two girls picked it out of a dictionary.
Yeah, Saoirse maintains she wasn't there. But we were definitely, I remember we were in Cleave's kitchen, and we flicked open a dictionary and found Wyvern, and we thought it was very epic because it's a two-legged dragon that can paralyze with its eyes.
Okay.
And we are obviously from Bray, and very coincidentally, you know, the gargoyle outside the town hall.
Yeah,
that is a wyvern. So it was a little bit of fate.
Yeah,
and
we always thought we would change it.
Yeah, we did.
And
it's really distinctive.
Thank you.
And look, you're going to Body and Soul, as I said, and that's running from June the 21st to Ballinlough Castle. What's it like to play at a major festival like that, as opposed to, say, just doing your own gig? Is it nice to play at a festival, Cuiva?
It is. Yeah, it's they're very different beasts for sure. I mean, and each, I get, the energy is so different. You know. And our music can be quite varied. So and at our own shows, there's a lot more moments of kind of, I guess, intimacy. Or, you know, there's a lot more kind of quiet moments, and it's a really, really different vibe. But at festivals, it's this high energy, and everybody's having a good time. And yeah, we're really, really excited to play.
Because Body and Soul is one we've wanted to play for a really long time. Yeah. And it's the 10-year anniversary. So it just feels really special this year to be playing for the first time on the main stage. So we're really excited about it, and excited to meet all the people that we're going to meet, and new people. And
it's great because the main stage is always great. You're also playing, I think, the Kaleidoscope Festival in Wicklow.
That's right. Yeah,
I think that's June the 30th.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and that's family friendly, which is lovely. That's kind of geared towards people who have kids, and that's great. You know, we're really looking forward to that, and that's a really cool lineup too.
Well, for more information about the festivals, everyone can go on to bodyandsoul.ie. and kaleidoscopefestival.ie. You're going to play us out with another of your song. What are you going to sing for us?
Yeah, this next one is, we're going to do an acoustic version of this song called Crawl.
And what's that about?
I suppose it's like dealing with the loss of something.
It's about betrayal, isn't
betrayal
it?
Betrayal as well, yeah.
It's an emotional one. And we normally, it's quite upbeat when our live set, but what we wanted to do for you this morning, Miriam, is strip everything back. And so we're just going to do this on the keys, kind of, I think, give a new edge to the song.
Yeah, well, you've got a beautiful voices and your sounds are superb. So best of luck with everything in your future career. Wyvern Lingard, thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Miriam.
And if you go to sing your last song.
Sick of your lies, I believed your alibis. You still need to apologize to me. This is a love hate. I suffocate. There's no need to resuscitate. You have your girl now. You have your new girl.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number 51551, and you can email Miriam at rt.ie. Well, the families and friends of the six people murdered in the Heights Bar in Lochan Island, County Down, in August 1994 seem no closer to obtaining justice for their loved ones. In fact, as the recent arrest and court case of two journalists involved in a documentary examining that case and naming the suspects has shown, relationships between the PSNI and journalists remains very fraught in Northern Ireland, and the chances of justice for those murdered seems as remote as ever. Well, joining me now are the two journalists involved. Good morning, Trevor Burney and Barry McCaffrey. Thanks so much for joining me from Belfast.
Thank you, Maria.
Good morning, morning.
Thanks so much for joining. Listen, I often think our listeners sometimes get confused. Do you mind one of you telling us, reminding people, first of all, before we speak about your documentary, No Stone Unturned, and what happened to both of you, tell us about what happened to, in Lochan Island on the 18th of June, 1994.
Well, on the 18th of June 1994, the little pub, the Heights Bar in Lochan Island, was packed just like many bars across the country, across the island on that night, as Ireland took on Italy at the 1994 World Cup, where Giant Stadium was full of Irish fans, full of expectation. And in the little Heights Bar, which is a tiny little front room bar, really, that's owned by the O'Toole family, still owned by the O'Toole family. And everyone was standing with their back to the door, watching a small TV that was hung up behind the bar. Behind the bar itself, the barman was Aidan O'Toole, son of the owner, Hugh O'Toole. And just shortly after half-time, a masked gunman wearing a boiler suit came through the door, dropped to his knee and opened fire with an automatic rifle. He killed six men and injured five before himself and his accomplice, who had held the door open for him, jumped into a red Triumph Acclaim car and sped off. The scene was obviously one of devastation, and very quickly news went out around the area about the attack. Later that evening, the UVF claimed responsibility for the attack and linked it to the death of some of its members who had been shot dead on the Shankill Road just a few days before. And that attack had raised concerns that there could be and a retaliatory response from the UVF. And for some reason, we still don't know really why to this day the Heights Bar in Lochan Island, a very sleepy little place and a very quiet, rural area of South Down, why it was chosen. But the attack and the scars of that attack still remain in Lochan Island today amongst the relatives and families of those who died that night.
And I know, Barry, you know, that Lochan Island, those murders there, something you've been investigating, I think, since your first job on the Down Democrat in 97. And actually, I'm just going to mention the six men who died, because I often know myself covering those North atrocities down the years, families like their loved ones to remember. It was Adrian Rogan, Malcolm Jenkinson, Barney Green, Daniel McCreener, Patsy O'Hare and Eamon Byrne. But you have, you like, you were trying to do something about this really since 97. Isn't that right, Barry?
Yes, Miriam, I suppose everybody here, everybody in Northern Ireland, or probably in the whole of Ireland, there'll always be, unfortunately, or there'll always be one atrocity or one incident that will mean something to them, that, you know, that'll stick in their head. And for me, it was Lochan Island, because I'd played, you know, GAA football as, you know, as a schoolboy down there. We played against the Lochan Island team. Really, in Lochan Island, as Trevor said, all there is the football pitch, the chapel and the bar. You know, Lochan Island, if you think of Skull and Cork, or, you know, Castle Blaney and Monaghan, that's the type of small, you know, village types that it is. So for Lochan Island, you know, I remember where I was on the night, and when the news came in, and my parents or friends had always been friends with the Rogans, so there had always been a personal connection with Lochan Island. And when I started as a young reporter, I was working in the area, but at that time the families had, and for 10 years the families had never said anything publicly. They didn't, because that's not the type of people they were. They put their trust in the police, because the police kept on telling them, "Don't worry, have faith in us. We know who these people are, who the killers are, and we'll bring you justice." And I think it's right that you've named the men that were killed, because in a lot of this, their identities and the fact that they were human beings are lost, and none of the men there that night were actually due to be in the bar for all sorts of different reasons. They all ended up in the bar just on that night. You know, Barney Green and Dan McCraner. Dan was Barney's nephew. He had been due to go in for a hernia operation on the Monday, so he knew that he wouldn't be able to bring Dan out. Dan was 87. Dan was the oldest victim of the Troubles. So Dan had brought Barney down to the bar because to watch the match, because he knew this was the last time for 6 weeks that they would he would get him out. So, you know, the two men walked their cattle down the road, and they put them in the field opposite and went into the bar. And what they would have done every other Saturday night, they would have come out after a few drinks and got the cattle and brought them back. Adrian Rogan was only there to pick up football tickets for the Down. We're playing in the Ulster final the next day. Malcolm Jenkinson, it was Father's Day, was the next day. His son was in England and asked his best friend Colm Smith, who was also injured, to bring Malcolm out to the bar for Father's Day. Malcolm had been working all day, didn't want to go. Patsy Byrne, or Patsy O'Hara Naaman Byrne, they were brother-in-laws, and they were only there because it was Cemetery Sunday. They were going to meet Patsy's father. Patsy's wife, Eamon's wife, had only left the bar seconds before the killers arrived. She actually drove past them as she was driving out. They were driving in. You know, she obviously didn't realise that anything was wrong. So, you know, for all sorts of reasons, all of those men just ended up at that bar at that time, and then the tragedy happened.
God, it's horrendous when you just even spell it out like that, Barry. Trevor, now the three, yourself, Trevor, Bernie, Barry, and obviously Alex Gibney, you put together this wonderful documentary called No Stone Unturned. Because, first of all, why did you make it? Was it because after all this time, no one's ever been brought to justice? And I suppose your doc also had examined persistent claims of state collusion in the murders, didn't it, Trevor?
Indeed, Miriam. Well, really, as you've just heard, when Barry and I began working together, Barry started to tell me some of the detail and the family connections. And I remember well, Loughton Island, I was working at Downtown Radio at the time and covered the immediate aftermath of it. So when Barry began to talk about Loughton Island, I was just working at the time with Alex Gibney on another film called Mea Maxima Culpa. And I began to talk to Alex about it and tell him about this story. And he lived not that far from Giant Stadium in New Jersey. So he was immediately interested, and we began to try to raise the funding for the film. And at that stage, there was some controversy back in 2011, 2012, when an ombudsman's report, a police ombudsman's report into the attack that was produced after the families had gone asking the ombudsman to investigate allegations of collusion. That ombudsman's report was quashed because it hadn't really properly dealt with the hadn't properly investigated. So at that point, we knew the story was very much alive, and we decided we were going to follow it as a new ombudsman's investigation began. And that report came forward in June 2016, and it confirmed that indeed there had been collusion between the RUC and the UVF. in this attack. So from that point in June 2016, we went into full production, and the film was produced premiered at the New York Film Festival in November 2017, and then went on release through Wildcard Films here in Ireland, North and South, the previous or the next month. So we were doing our own investigation, following very much the work of Barry McCaffrey here. He was a person who really knew the families intensely, who knew the story, knew the detail, and we were able to produce our own evidence apart from what the ombudsman found. But we had very much reached the same conclusion as he had. And really that was that police were very much aware of who was responsible for the attack within hours. And in this case, the special branch, RUC special branch, had told detectives the morning after the attack of who they believed were the main suspects. And those suspects remain the same suspects today.
And of course, you crucially named in the documentary, both of you, three of the men who you believed carried out the massacre. And you didn't, I think, on police advice, didn't name a UVF informant. Barry, take me through. I mean, before we get into the arrest of both of you, what was it like when you're making a documentary? Obviously, you have to deal with maybe the police. How was your relationship during the making of the documentary? Lead us through that.
Well, I suppose obviously the police have their job to do. The police ombudsman had his job to do, and we had our job to do. What it's important to say is that this film wasn't about criticising policing or the RUC or probably the most crucial individual or part of the film was a retired policeman, Jimmy Binns, because Jimmy was able to tell the story about how himself and other detectives had uncovered different evidence and had tried to do their best, had tried to put the killers behind bars, but they were thwarted. There was dark arts going on above their heads, and when we first contacted Jimmy or first came across him, you'll know yourself, Miriam, and any other journalist or filmmaker will know, when you find somebody like that, 99 times out of 100, they don't want to speak, or they'll want an anonymity, because when Jimmy Binns took part in this film and told the story that he had to tell, his life changed forever, because his old police family, that was him. They will never speak to him again. Jimmy had left the police and had gone on to work as a counsellor in West Belfast, and he couldn't go back to West Belfast after the film because everybody that now knew that he was had been a policeman. Mm-hmm. So the personal sacrifice that Jimmy Binns was making in telling his story, His life was being changed forever. On one hand, the police, his old police friends, were never going to speak to him again, and on the other hand, his new life, his career, and everything else, he was sacrificing that as well.
And just to follow on there, Miriam, Barry was bringing this information to the film, and myself and Alex were working together. Alex was editing the film in New York, and we were shooting interviews here in Belfast and Lochan Island, and the film was building. But Alex called one day and said, I think in order really to understand what happened here, we're going to have to name the suspects. And as you know well, in Northern Ireland, that's a very difficult moment. It's a difficult moment for any journalist, in that you have to really consider the full import of what that actually means and the impact of that. So we wrestled with it, and with everyone who was involved in the project, we wrestled with that. But we did come to the conclusion, yes, we were going to have to name the suspects in order to really, really explain to an audience what Lochan Island was really about. So we decided then at that stage, which was unusual, to say the least, and I can't remember a previous stage we've done this, but in my career or previous experience of doing this, but we decided to go to the police. So we called the press office, we asked for a meeting, and we were granted a meeting with the Assistant Chief Constable, Steve Martin. And in that meeting, we said to him that we intended to name four suspects in the attack. We were definitely naming three. A fourth we were wrestling with at that stage. And that we really wanted to pass on that information to police, because the last thing the Loughran Island families wanted was any kind of retribution or any sense of revenge against any of these suspects, that and that we felt as journalists we had the evidence and the information to be able to name the suspects, and that but that we knew that only police could decide whether or not we were increasing the life or increasing the risk to life of any of these suspects by naming them. Now this was back in April 2017. And so that meeting that was attended by three of the production team, along with Steve Martin and others, then we left that with the PSNI. We also knew that the police ombudsman was briefing the PSNI about our meetings with the ombudsman and the fact that we knew who the suspects were and that our intentions were to identify them in the film. So we knew there was information in the police hands that really meant, which was a huge risk to us, that if they decided that the best thing to do was to injunct the film or prevent the film from coming into the public domain, they had all the information they needed to go in order to do that. And that was worrying for all of us, because obviously after all the work that we'd put into the film, we wanted it to come out, and we felt it was very important that it come out. But we thought it was the best thing to do was to brief the police of our intentions, and they could make up their minds, they could make the assessments, they would do the analysis, decide whether or not there would be any risk to these suspects' lives.
And then you were both arrested. Did that come, take me through it, Barry or Trevor? Why, yeah. did you expect to be arrested? Did that come out of the blue? How shocking was it?
Yes, well, no, it certainly came out of the blue. When the film premiered, within days, the PSNI announced that they were going to investigate the films, the allegations of the films of the film, but they didn't say that they would investigate the actual allegations, the serious allegations of collusion and everything else that that had been exposed in the film. What they said was they were going to investigate how we had received a leaked document, and much of the film is based on a leaked police ombudsman's document, which gave key parts of the what had gone on in the attack, and had also named the killers. So the police, instead of investigating the allegations in the film, they wanted to find the whistleblower and who had leaked this document to us. So in a certain way, We were concerned that this investigation was now on, that the PSNI were now coming after us in some way. But the normal way, as you know yourself, Murray, in cases of leaked documents, if a government or a police force or they want, if you have a leaked document and they want it back from you, they go to court and they try and get the court to grant a thing called a production order, which means that you go into court, the police argue their bit, we argue ours, and the judge decides whether we should have to hand the document back or whether in the public interest it is right for journalists to hold on to the material. But the police didn't. On August the 31st, 2018, there was a knock. Well, for me, there was a knock on my door at 7 a.m. I was working in the BBC. At that time, there's a knock at the door. I answered the door, and it was a big policeman in the boiler suit and everything you sort of see here. And he was very amicable. He said he's here. He had a search warrant to search my home, and could he come in? And the police then searched my home, and I'm not making any criticism of the police. They didn't break anything. They weren't abusive. They were totally professional. And then they let me wash. They let me dress. And at that stage, I'd say to them, "Here's the key. I'm going to work now. Can you pop it through the letterbox when you're finished?" And at that stage, he said, "No, you're not going to work today." I said, "We're going to have to arrest you now," and that was a bit of a shock, you know. And at that stage, you realise, right, this is starting to get serious, you know. We're now really under the microscope. So I was taken away in a police car, I was taken to Musgrave Street, Serious Crime Suite, in the centre of Belfast. Now on the first floor. The ground floor Musgrave Street Police Station, it's for shoplifters and people who get drunk and have fights or whatever. The second floor, that's the penthouse. That's for the murderers, the Osama bin Ladens.
And the Barry McCaffreys.
Well, that's, yeah, the Bernie suite. Trevor has his own suite. So I'm brought up. Luckily enough, the detective, when I was leaving the house, I'd said to him, "Can I bring a book?" And he said, yeah, take a book, because you know it's like a dentist or a hospital waiting room. You're going to be waiting around for a while. And when he was booking me in, he'd say to me, "Hold on to your book." He says, "Don't let them take your book off you, because the first thing they'll try and do is get the book." I always thought I'm sorry, I'm going on a bit here. When he was handing me over to the desk sergeant to be put in a cell, I always assumed that he had shaken my hand and thanked me, but Trevor, it reminds me, because he read the statements last weekend, that it was the policeman in his affidavit or his statement says that I actually thanked him and shook his hand. So you're put in a cell, to be honest, the first thing you do when you find yourself in that situation, I just got under the blanket and had a wee cry, you know. And all you want to do at that stage, all you want is your mummy. You know, I'm 48 years of age, 49 now, and all I wanted was my mummy. And because at that stage, the biggest problem that you have at that stage is you're not in control. You don't know what's happening. You don't know who else is being arrested. You don't know what they have against you. And you feel as if you feel as if the world's against you. After about what I assume would be half an hour, but you don't have a watch or there's no TV in the cell. After about half an hour, I hear this voice booming down the wing, you know, outside the cells. And it was like Julie Andrews to me. It was like the Sound of Music. Because it was Trevor Burney being put in the cell about three doors down from me. And at that stage, I realised we're going to be okay. Because I knew that Trevor was my co-accused. And, you know, you're not alone at that stage. Trevor will probably tell you what happened next.
And I know Trevor, since then, obviously, you've been cleared. The arrests have been, you know, nothing's going to happen. And I know you're both very conscious to talk about the victims of Loch Anand, and that's why you made your documentary. But it must have been pretty terrifying when you were arrested as well, Trevor, was it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a very similar situation to Barry. In fact, the 31st of August last year was always going to be a difficult day. We had, for myself and my wife and the three daughters, we had some really close family had come in from London the night before, and there were three children under the age of seven in the house on the morning of 31st of August. And our youngest daughter, Freya, that was her first day back at school. And as you can imagine, she really didn't like the idea of going to school when her two closest cousins were, you know, at home, and she wanted to spend time with them. So Freya was already upset whenever the knock came to the door, and Sheila looked out the window and kind of narrated what she was seeing and saying, "There's an awful lot of cars outside," and then, "Oh my God, there's an awful lot of police cars outside." And she looked at me and said, "What is that about?" And I have to say, I immediately knew that it was something to do with Loch Anand Island. We opened the door, and you know, over a dozen officers came through into the house, And just the same experience as Barry, they told us they were going to search the house first, and Sheila was remonstrating with them, you know, why were they coming after us rather than going after the killers? And then they led me into another room and told me that I was under arrest and I was placed in a car and taken away, you know. And I'll never forget the look of my brother-in-law from the kitchen, who's born and brought up in London, looking at me as if to go, this can't be about a documentary, this can't be about a film, you know. And I'll never forget that look of suspicion that there must be something much more grievous going on here. So anyway, we spent 14 hours in the police station being questioned, and that was all a bit of a farce, to be honest. You know, at one stage we were questioned about the leak of the details of a police officer that we'd found in France, and they accused us of being leaked this information from the police ombudsman's office, when indeed after some time of being questioned about this, I asked them if they had investigated whether the policeman's details were in the public domain, and they said they had. And I said, well, do you know where we got the details from? And they said, no. And I said, well, have you checked the French phone book? Albert Carroll's name and address and phone numbers in the French phone book, and that is where Barry McCaffrey found it. So we'd, you can imagine the frustration that was building, that this was a case that we'd been arrested in front of our family, in front of our neighbours, we'd been taken away. And a statement had been put out that it was about the theft of documents, which I still feel very frustrated and angry about, that, you know, we are journalists, we were leaked documents, and the police decided they were investigating us, accusing us of having stolen the documents. And I still don't understand why the police said that, despite the fact that the Ombudsman has now said categorically several times to the Irish Times that he never reported a theft of documents from his office. So it was all very surreal, to be honest. And I think even at this stage now, almost 10 months on, it's still rather surreal to be sitting on Sunday morning talking about being arrested in Northern Ireland, you know, 21 years after the Good Friday Agreement. My eldest daughter's 18, and, you know, this has now become so much part of our lives, and really, unfortunately, at a very important time for them, going through exams and deciding what to do with their lives, and really what they want to do is now to leave Belfast because of what really has happened to myself and Barry. And there's all sorts of still of repercussions and that we're dealing with personally and with families and all of that. And I think, so it's been terribly frustrating. And we decided on the day of our arrest, when my solicitor came into the cell, Niall Murphy, he said that our offices had also been raided and that there were police officers going through our computers and our notebooks. And I said, well, is there anything we can do, or what do we do? And he says, well, you could take a judicial review, because we believe they're taking documents that are completely unrelated to the film. So on that day, Niall got word out to his colleagues, and we began taking a judicial review of the search warrants that were used both at Barry's home, at my home, and in the office. And by 6 o'clock that evening, we had an interim injunction in place that prevented police from looking at the materials that they had seized from the office, which is only just one street away from City Hall. And, you know, that included notebooks and documents that were related to investigations that some of our colleagues were doing into sex abuse within the Catholic Church, in a famous case, or infamous case here in Newry, that had just broken last year. And the police had decided to lift these confidential notes that that our colleagues had. And then, so we got the judicial review, and that in itself became a very pressurised process for myself and Barry, as we tried to, tried to resource this judicial review, get it up and running, and the NUJ and Amnesty International and other international colleagues came in and supported us, which was fantastic. Gave us moral support, gave Barry financial support in taking the judicial review. But we carried it through, and then 3 weeks ago there was a hearing in the High Court in Belfast, in which the Lord Chief Justice and two other judges sat for 2 days or 2.5 days, and at the end came back with a judgment saying that the police had acted unlawfully and inappropriately, and in fact everything that we had done in protecting our sources was exactly what a journalist should do in that situation, and we'd always acted appropriately. So that was a huge relief and a huge amount of pressure lifted off our shoulders.
Well, look, Trevor and Barry, how can people watch No Stone Unturned after all you've been through? And for all the people of Loch Inan, they still won't give up hope. Hopefully that one day somebody will be brought to justice. But how can they watch it, your great documentary?
Well, it's on Amazon Prime, and I suppose it's been shown all over the world, but I suppose one of our biggest regrets is it hasn't been shown on terrestrial TV here in Northern Ireland or in the South, where we feel that the biggest lessons, if there are lessons to be learned from this film, that's where the people who need to learn the lessons, you know, if it was shown on terrestrial TV, that was the biggest message, and that was the promise that we made to the Loch Inan Island families. So, you know, it is on Amazon Prime and things like that, but our hope would still be that national TV thing would show it, you know. And just one last thing, Miriam.
Yeah.
I think if there's been one good thing that's come out of this, or that will come out of this, it's the Lord Chief Justice, the ruling that he will give, his written ruling, that will be sent down from the courts. It will reinforce, or it will set in stone, the rights of journalists to protect their sources, and that journalists have a right to ask those awkward questions. Because this is what, to us, this is what this case was about. This case was about, and it wasn't about Loch Inan Island, or it wasn't about the Troubles. To us, it was an attack on press freedom, that it was the state saying, you the journalists, don't ask those awkward questions, because if you do, you'll end up in a police cell. Mm. And they tried to send us to jail. The good thing that came out of this is that the Lord Chief Justice has now set down in stone that journalists have a right. The investigative journalism isn't a crime.
No.
Journalists have a right to do their jobs.
Well, look, well...
And we think that's very important.
Well done to both of you, Barry McCaffrey and Trevor Burney, for a great documentary. Hopefully it will be shown on TV on this island soon.
And fingers crossed.
Thanks for taking the time. I know you're going off to celebrate Father's Day with your family, so enjoy that. Brilliant. And well
thank
done
you,
on all
thanks,
your hard
Miriam.
Work.
Thank
no,
you.
Thank you both very much. We'll take a break.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Yeah, welcome back. Our text number 51551. Lots of reaction there to our interviews with Trevor Barry. I have no time to read them out because good morning, Phelim Drew. Phelim Drew's in here on this great Father's Day to talk about his wonderful father, Ronnie. You're going to start with the song. What are you going to sing, Phelim?
This is a song called Canción Mixteca.
Off you go.
Qué lejos estoy del suelo donde he nacido. Intensa nostalgia invade mi pensamiento. Y al verme tan solo y triste cual hoy al vento, quisiera llorar, quisiera morir de sentimiento. Oh, tierra del sol, suspiro por verte. Ahora que lejos yo vivo sin luz, sin amor. Y al verme tan solo y triste cual hoy al vento, quisiera llorar, quisiera morir de sentimiento. Thank you.
tierra de sol. Suspiro por verte. Ahora aquí lejos, yo vivo sin luz, sin amor. Y al verme tan solo y triste cual hoy al viento, ¿qué será? Llorar, ¿qué será? Morir de sentimiento.
Ah, oh, that was beautiful, Fenham. You're accompanied there by Anto Drennan and Gerry Connolly. You come down here, Fenham, and chat to me for a short while. Sure. That was beautiful. On Father's Day, your father loves Spanish songs, doesn't he? Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, you know, he spent many years in the mid to late 50s in Spain. He went over with a group of guys that he had been working with at the telephone exchange. They were artists and writers, and he went off to Spain on and off for about 5 years. And it really had a huge influence on him, on his appreciation of food and cigars, yeah, and fine wines.
You are so like him now. I'm just sitting looking off to do slightly different eyes, but you're so like. Now, you put together this tribute show celebrating Ronnie Drew, the Dubliners and Friends, and it's going to be at the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire. Anyone who wants to go, obviously, tickets from pavilionthatre.ie. Tell me about the show.
Yeah, well, it kind of grew out of a show we did in the Whale Theatre in Greystones last summer. And I'm very lucky to have Anto Drennan on guitar and Gerry O'Connor. Gerry plays with the Dublin Legends. Anto is actually doing a gig with the Moving Hearts on the 9th and 10th of July. That's going to be pretty exciting. So and we have Bernard Kavanagh on double bass. So the what do you call it? The show is looking at songs like, you know, Finnegan's Wake, Three Lovely Lassies from Kimmage. You know, we do Sullivan's John. There's a lot of songs there from the Dubliners back catalogue, and then a few yarns and stuff like that. You know, get to tell a few stories about Barney and that sort of thing, and my elf and that.
Everyone would love it. Well, look, I have completely run out of time. You go back over, I'm going to give you a Barbra song. My producer's going to kill me. You're going to sing a minute of what?
This is called Moving Day by Charlie Poole.
You go back over, and just again, celebrating Ronnie Drew, the Dubliners and Friends is at the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire. Tickets on pavilionthatre.ie. You should definitely get them. Sounds like it'll be great. My thanks today to Denise Davies, our BCO, Nikki Dempsey in sound, Shanna Gorman produced. Take it away. Phelan Drew, Anto Drennan and Gerry O'Connor.
Well, the landlord said this morning to me, give me the key, the flat ain't free. I ain't had no rent out of you, so pack up your bags and skidoo. I'm just waiting for my honey to come home. She's my honey from my honeycomb. She's got dough, she told me so this morning. Now it's moving day, moving day. Rip the carpet up off the floor, close the oil stove and out the door, cause it's moving day. Pack up your rags and get away, pretend you never ever did live in a tent, cause it's moving day. Snow. I said, hello, give me some dough. Here's the landlord waiting on the rent. Honey said, I ain't got a cent. Well, here's two chickens I brought home for stew. Landlord.